Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Alice Randall was the first Black woman to write a chart-topping country hit in 1994. But all of Randall's music has been recorded by white artists in a genre that has often silenced or even denied its Black roots. But now Black women country artists are re-recording Randall's work for the new album My Black Country, and Randall's new book of the same name takes us, as her subtitle says, on a journey through country music's Black past, present, and future. We'll look at the impact of Dee Ford Bailey, Linda Martell, and of course, Beyoncé. Join us. There's a tornado in my city. In the basement. That ain't pretty. Rugged whiskey. We surviving. A break of kisses, sweet redemption. Passing time, yeah. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. After songwriter Alice Randall became the first Black woman to write a chart-topping country hit, X's and O's, sung by Trisha Yearwood in 94, she would have to wait 30 years for a Black woman's song to reach number one on the country charts sung by a Black woman. But it happened in February of this year with Beyoncé's Texas Hold'em, the lead single off the album Cowboy Carter. Here's its track, Yeah Yeah.
We snapping.
Pretty place.
Tom's place. We want to welcome you to the Beyoncé Cowboy Carter Act 2 in a rodeo chilling circuit.
Beyoncé's album broke streaming records this week. It also pays tribute to some of country music's greats like Dolly Parton, Willie Nelson, and Linda Martell, and pushes the genre in a way only Beyoncé can. Alice Randall says it's a museum, an education, an all-out celebration of country, and it's Black as the winning ace of spades. Alice Randall, songwriter, producer, and author, joins me now. Welcome to Forum.
I am thrilled to be with you in San Francisco.
Oh, it is wonderful to talk with you. I've heard you say that you can retire now, which is a pretty big thing to say for someone whose mission it's been for people to know Black country music. So what has Beyoncé accomplished with this for you?
She has accomplished so many things, but one is that little literal thing. I arrived here 41 years ago to be a country songwriter and country song publisher, and I had three goals. One was to get my own first country song recorded. Another was to spotlight the achievement of Black people who had gone before me in the genre. And the third one was to see a Black woman artist at the top of the charts. I got those first two things done, and I think done well. But I have been here 41 years, and I thought I will turn 65 May 4th, that I would get to my retirement from country and Western music and not see that last. And then Beyoncé gets there with Texas Hold'em, a song that I actually kind of adore. So,
yeah, and you say by here, Nashville, right? 41 years in Nashville?
I've been in 41 years in Nashville. And well, in the country music business, because some of it I was living away from Nashville, but the majority that in Nashville.
And you say you love Texas Hold'em. What defines a country song, and how are these sort of classic subjects and sounds in country reflected in Beyoncé's album?
Well, I think there are two ways of looking at it. The simplest formula I know is country music is Celtic, English, Irish, Scottish ballad forms a focus on storytelling, plus African-American influences, which could be instrumentation, the banjo, or it can be an approach to nature, such as sacred nature coming from Africa, plus evangelical Christianity. When you get that Celtic storytelling ballad form, plus Black influences, plus evangelical Christianity, you are in the vicinity of a country music song. I call it a likeliness test, not a litmus test. To take one more layer, there's some abiding country themes. And the four for me are this: life is hard, God is real, the road, family, liquor are significant compensations, and the past is better than the present. The past is better than the present is often where we find a racial divide in country. Mm. In much of white country, the past that is better than the present is a mythologized Dixie or an earlier part of the 20th century. In African-American country, the past that is better than the present is often a moment in childhood where a Black parent is successfully able to shelter the child against prevailing racism, against all odds, or it is a lost and longed for Africa before colonization.
You've talked about how... Yeah, go ahead.
And all of that is present in Texas Hold'em. One of the things that Texas Hold'em is about, it's a dance tune. But the whole point of it is life is not a game, that there's a God presence in there. It's not a game of Texas Hold'em. It actually has the word redemption in it. So there's all that evangelical Christianity all up in it. The love the couple are experiencing, the honky-tonk they're going into, all of that is the road and familial joy as compensation. And it also has that African sense of nature. Nature is present in the song in both the tornado and in the honey. Nature is both a danger and a sustenance. All that complexity is going on in that dance tune. And that is why Beyoncé is a genius.
And you are talking about how her songs reflect some of these classic points about country music, the things that make a country song, as you described so beautifully. But you've also said that she's deconstructing them and reconstructing them for today. What impact do you think this is having on country?
It is broadening the audience and raising the bar. Hmm. For example, the song Protector on the album, which is one of my favorites, which is a mother-child song. It does some very complex work. Just even the word protector as a translation of mother raises the profile of women. It shifts. The woman is not overly vulnerable. She's fierce and nurturing. She's a protector. She's capable. It changes the understanding of who and what a mother is.
I want to play just a little bit from the song, If That Ain't Country, because it speaks a little bit about everything that Beyoncé is doing, but yet she was also rejected in some ways.
They used to say I spoke too country, then the rejection came, said I wasn't country enough, said I wouldn't settle up.
Sorry, that was from American Requiem. And it's one of the points that I want to make. She's doing all these incredible things for the genre, but there's a tremendous amount of backlash as well. I mean, I guess it was to be expected. There was going to be some backlash. But I'm curious what you think about the backlash and what is being communicated with the insistence by some that country music is white music.
Well, the idea that country music is white music is a lie. Country music, for its whole recorded history and its whole history on the radio, has included Black voices, Black aesthetics, Black genius. But that has been erased from much of the story country tells about itself. So what I find here is this is work of education and reclamation. But to just start, in 1927, D. Ford Bailey, the first time the words Grand Ole Opry were spoken on the radio, the next sound that was heard was D. Ford Bailey, the father of Black country, and the Opry's first superstar, a Black man who considered himself to be a third generation Black hillbilly musician. The first sound we heard after those words, Grand Ole Opry, was D. Ford Bailey playing Pan American Blues on WSM. So Black people have been in country, and have been creating in country. I said I was thrilled to be with you in San Francisco, and I meant that for this very particular reason. In 1930, Lil Hardin Armstrong will perform on Blue Yodel No. 9. Many, many scholars and many general listeners consider that song to be the most iconic country single of all time. It was country's first million-selling single record. A black woman is on every bar of the song, but her name didn't get put on the label. And what the Lil recorded that song with Jimmy Rogers and Louis Armstrong in California, in Los Angeles, in 1930. So Louis's trumpet is on it. So here's another black musician on the song. And what's interesting, 16 Carriages was the other song that Beyonce released on the Super Bowl Sunday. It has a trumpet on it. Some people say, what's that trumpet doing on a country song? There is a trumpet on Blue Yodel No. 9, Louis Armstrong's trumpet. But you don't show the faces, and people call that sound white. But there were three people playing on the session, three geniuses, Jimmy Rogers, Lil Hardin Armstrong, and Louis Armstrong. Three geniuses on Blue Yodel No. 9, and two of them were black. And that sound is a pure hillbilly sound. And that connects us back to D. Fort Bailey, who perceived himself as being in the third generation of black hillbilly performers. So Lil, actually, before she gets to L.A., she got to San Francisco. She took the train from Chicago with King Oliver's band to San Francisco and was playing in San Francisco in 1921. That was her first taste of the continent, of evading cultural redlining, of seeing the Pacific Ocean, turning her back on the Atlantic, seeing the Pacific. She lands in San Francisco and never forgot it. My favorite portrait of Lil is a photograph of her with King Oliver's band on the streets of San Francisco.
We are talking with Alice Randall about the Black country artists who are getting their due in her new book, My Black Country. And let's go into the break hearing what she is describing here. Lil Hardin playing piano for Blue Yodel No. 9.
$100 cash just for me a suit of clothes. She come to the joint, a 44 in each hand. She said, stand aside all you women and men, 'cause I'm looking for my man.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. That's D. Ford Bailey's Pan American Blues. My guest, Alice Randall, has called him the father of the first family of country. Her new book, My Black Country, traces country music's black past and looks to the future with the release of Beyonce's Cowboy Carter. And your listeners are invited to join the conversation. Are you a country music fan? If so, what do you love about it? And what makes a song country to you? Have you listened to Cowboy Carter? Do you have any thoughts or favorite tracks from that? And who are your favorite black artists in country music? Or who do you think has been unsung or undersung in the history of country? Tell us by emailing forum@kqed.org. Find us on our social channels at KQED Forum or call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Alice, you've called D4 Bailey's performance of that song in 1927 the moment black country was born. Can you just tell us a little bit more about it? You referenced it before the break, but just talk about the impact that it had and how D4 was able to make it as a black man in 1927.
Well, as I said, first of all, he was drawing on his own roots, that his father played music and his grandfather very successfully played music. And I think that D. Ford connected with his audience in complex ways. You just played Pan American Blues. And one of the things I note about that is when D. Ford was on the airways in the 20s, people lived near train tracks. They didn't need an imitation train sound. They needed a sound that functioned as a train, a sound that would allow them to imaginatively travel when they couldn't travel. So D. Ford had a true genius to him. His song Fox Chase, which sounds like literally a fox chase to some degree, but there's something joyful and playful in it that is essence of country, because the chased fox seems to be winning. There's a happiness in it. It's a chased fox. How does he win? Maybe because you get to heaven and where you tell people, I'm going to tell Jesus how you did me. That's that evangelical Christianity. And maybe it's that African trickster tale where you got a trick up your sleeve and the chase fox might be leading the chaser into a ditch. All of that is in D. Ford's Fox Chase. He was a very subtle man. And I've got to fast forward and say that when I first moved to Nashville in 1983, D. Ford had died about a year before. As I told you, he was the first star of the Opry. Many of the early white acts would take D. Ford out on the road with them because he drew the big crowd and they wanted to draw the crowd, play to the crowd he drew. But, and that includes the great Roy Acuff. But I don't have that much respect for Roy Acuff, because at the 25th anniversary of the founding of the CMA, Roy Acuff talked about country music being a family. He calls Jimmy Rogers his name, but he doesn't call D. Ford Bailey's name, a man he had stood on the stage and sung beside. And more importantly, when I first got to town, I got a chance to meet Mr. Roy Acuff and many of the people who had been around. They told me a story about D. Ford getting too lazy to write new songs and dying in poverty as a shoeshine boy. That could not be further from the truth. The most important part of the truth for me is in the late 60s and 70s, D. Ford Bailey was an ally of Avon N. Williams, who became the first black state senator in Tennessee history, and part of what got him in office, a jingle written and performed by D. Ford Bailey. That Senator Avon N. Williams would go on to desegregate almost every school system in Tennessee but Shelby County, to be my own daughter's grandfather. And he banged the table and told me, when I wrote him a jingle and thought it was the first one, "You didn't write," he said, "D. Ford Bailey wrote my first jingle." So he ended up being a political artist who performed to the very end, raised a son and a grandson who also performed country music. But his art was so political, he helped put Avon Williams in office. And if you read My Black Country, you'll hear how he inspired Avon at the end of his career when he was fighting ALS, because D. Ford Bailey had had polio as an early child and had to deal with a lot of ableist, not only anti-racist language, but anti-ableist language that was bigoted against him because people would describe him untruly as being misshapen. As opposed, he was differentially abled, but he was in no way disabled.
Well, this listener on Discord writes, I don't have a relationship with country music, but remember on road trips when the radio stations were only playing country music, could we talk about Charlie Pride? So you called Dee Ford the father of the first family of country music, Lil Hardin, who we talked about before the break, the mother, and you've called Charlie Pride sort of their side child.
Or love child.
Or love child. Tell us why and tell us more about Charlie Pride and what he went through.
Well, I love Charlie Pride. I call Charlie Pride Dee Ford's love child or side child. There's nothing sophisticated about him in the way that would allow him to be any part of Lil Hardin's, because who would go on to be this great jazz woman? So I said, he's country as cornbread, Charlie Pride, and I think he'd appreciate that description. But there's a lot more to Charlie Pride than that. But he will become the second black man, second black person to be a member of the Opry. First is Dee Ford, then will be Charlie Pride. So Charlie Pride is, just to locate him, remember this about him. In 1971, Charlie Pride is Entertainer of the Year for the CMA Association, the Country Music Association. Charlie Pride will become the first black person to go into the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum and Rotunda, into that. He's the first one to get that honor. He's going to pave the way for Dee Ford and Ray Charles, who actually come ahead of him chronologically in their creations. But they were not accepted in the ways Charlie Pride was by the music establishment. To notice another thing is, I believe in 1983 when I arrived, Charlie Pride had been in the number one spot on the country music charts 29 times. By the day I arrived, he would be about to take his last trip to the top of the charts in the early 80s. So he had actually extraordinary success. Entertainer of the Year, 30 number ones, influential to artists till now, including Garth Brooks. How they launched him is very interesting. He comes out of the Negro Leagues, out of baseball. And I think this is one of the secrets of Charlie Pride's success. He himself loved the Negro Leagues, was on the board of the Negro League Museum in Kansas City. But he stood on the stage with a kind of athleticism. He did not stand on the country stage as an entertainer, though he will win Entertainer of the Year. He stood on the stage like an athletic, intellectual, stunningly beautiful slugger. And I do think that something about that coming out of athletics, where Southern white men had some experience of watching and acknowledging the ability of black sportsmen, it translated into a kind of respect for Charlie Pride on the stage.
Well, we've got the song Kiss an Angel Good Morning by Charlie Pride. I don't know if you want to say a word about it.
It's a wonderful one of those country reversals. Kiss an angel good morning, love him like the devil when you get back home. And there's all that evangelical Christianity up in it too.
The secret I'm speaking of is a woman and a man in love. And the answer is in this song that I always sing. You've got to kiss an angel good morning and let her know you think about her when you're gone. Kiss an angel good morning.
That's Charlie Pride's Kiss an Angel Good Morning. You talk about Alice Randall, how he was accepted for his athleticism, but early on, his race was hidden from the public, essentially, right, to get him to be accepted?
He was initially put on the radio without any imagery, that they did not put his face on any or body on any of the materials. He will, quote unquote, come out as black in Detroit, Michigan. In my lifetime, I still remember people gossiping about it a little bit in the town. And so they did establish him first with, I call it incognito. They established him, his voice, and then they showed the rest of him. Huh.
So another person who was coming out in the 60s and 70s, Linda Martell. She had
you know, the incredible distinguishing historic moment of being one of the first women, right, to perform, black women to perform.
She was the first black woman to perform on the Opry at the Ryman Auditorium, the first. Yeah. And she would stand on that stage 12 times. But she never went incognito. She is on the cover of her Plantation Records album in the late 60s. Linda Martell is a stunningly beautiful woman. She looks like a little bit of a cross between Bobby Gentry and Lynn Anderson, black, if you that style. She looks great in a mini skirt. She looks both like the girl next door and a little bit sexy. She has a sweet, sweet voice that is pretty across so many different notes. And she has an extraordinary ability to interpret songs, to add layers to the story being told. And she has great song sense. That album, Color Me Country, which has a song on it called Color Me, Color Him Father. All the songs in it are so well chosen. One of the ones that I love is about black couple migrating from the South to San Francisco. I think it's called San Francisco. It's a lonely town. It's a little bit like that country classic Streets of Baltimore, but it's talking about the people who don't come on the Volkswagen buses, but come on the Trailways buses that come on riding the Silver Dog, the Greyhound. And it's a wonderful album. She put it out. She had the voice. She had the looks. She had big producer behind her, and it is dead in the water. Almost as quickly, her time in Nashville is measured in months, hardly years. And she goes back to South Carolina. And we see right there, I have a song called Small Towns Are Smaller for Girls, which is true. And Music Row is a small town. And it's hard for women in the music industry and country music. But small towns are even smaller for black girls. And in the case of Linda Martell, in the late 60s, in the early 70s, country music proved that emphatically, that small towns are smaller for black girls.
On Beyoncé's new album, there's a track called The Linda Martell Show. And there's also this track called Spaghetti from Linda Martell, where she talks about the notion of genres. And I just want to play a little bit of this for you.
Genres are a funny little concept, aren't they? Yes, they are.
That Beyoncé Virgo.
In theory, they have a simple definition that's easy to understand. But in practice, well, some may feel confined.
I swear for God is God is God.
So I wonder what you see the significance of Beyoncé paying tribute to her in her album as.
I think that it is Sankofa. It's looking back to move forward. Two of the polls I find most interesting and performances on the album. You just played Linda Martell speaking. Rumi speaks. That is Beyoncé's daughter, speaks at the beginning of Protector. Play me the lullaby. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. So with Linda Martell's inclusion, she is looking back to the country past of a woman artist who did not get her, black woman artist who was not given her space. And with Rumi's inclusion, she's looking towards country's future. Here is a little girl that will have been on a millions selling country record before she turns 7 years old. What is her future in country? And I love what Linda Martell is doing with playing with the idea of genre. I have the phrase cultural redlining. And I think that this is the idea that some people are put into circumscribed spaces geographically and artistically. But we have to understand that genre was created within the music spheres as a means of marketing. That people thought that dividing up these audiences along racial lines would lead to more profits. That part of what you might be buying when you bought a country song would be buying into some kind of identity of whiteness or white superiority. What you might be buying if you buy a blues song is buying into an identification with black suffering. There's nothing intrinsic about genre, but it doesn't mean there aren't insights to be found by dissecting how a song works inside and outside of a genre or pushes at the limits of that genre.
Well, David wrote in, I'm a fan of Charlie Pride and always sought out this kind of music. There's a new black country artist named Yola that I'm a big fan of that's making similar music. Do you know Yola?
I certainly know Yola's music, and I know Yola a little bit. I ran into Yola once, and she said she was genre fluid, and I love that say.
I don't know if you want to say anything more about her.
She has a stunning voice and amazing taste. And she's part of this new group of people that have arrived in Nashville. A lot of them are associated, or I run into them in East Nashville, Allison Russell, Yola, Rhiannon Giddens, who is now coming in from Ireland. But there's Sister Strings live in East Nashville. So I think that's part of the collection of new voices. But it's important to know, when Rumi says, play the lullaby, what's important to me about that is, in my black country, I imagine the first country song. This is an imagining moment. And that first country song that I imagine is something that would have been sung in the 17th century, maybe on the Eastern Shore, maybe in Virginia. And it would be an enslaved African woman who had come to these United States in shackles, and she's singing to the child she's born. And she's taking some of these new Celtic ballad forms she's hearing, she's adding it to African melodies she knows, and this evangelical Christianity she's starting to pray. And that's the first country song. We don't have it recorded, but that's its aesthetic.
We are talking about the past, the present, and the future of black artists and country music with none other than Alice Randall, and we'll have more after the break. We're listening to Linda Martell's Color Him Father. He took us in, and now we belong to the man with that big white grin. I've got to color him father. I'm gonna color him love. I've got to color him father. Well, she's got her. That's the song X's and O's, sung by Trisha Yearwood in 1994. It was written by my guest, Alice Randall, making her the first black woman to write a number one country hit in 1994. And you, our listeners, are joining my conversation with Alice Randall, a songwriter and professor of African American and Diaspora Studies and a writer in residence at Vanderbilt University. Her new book, My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future. And join the conversation. Tell us if you're a country music fan and why you love it and what makes a song country to you. Your reactions to Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter and what you think it's doing for country music. Maybe your favorite black artists in country music or ones who have been unsung or undersung in your view. You can email forum at kqed.org. Find us on our social channels at KQED Forum. We're on Twitter, Instagram, or digital community on Discord. And you can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. A listener is commenting on our discussion on genre, writing interesting discussion about genre. I do like Johnny Cash since his music transcends country. Plus, as a child, we used to watch his TV variety show. We were just hearing Trisha Yearwood sing Your X's and O's. And Alice, I have to imagine that must have been quite a moment when it hit number one, a song you wrote.
It was a big moment. It was an even bigger moment the next week when it had its second week at number one, because that's the audience. The first week, sometimes that's a lot of the record label and everybody working it. When it stays up there for 2 weeks when no one's trying for that, that song has just made a relationship with the audience. And what's exciting about it for me, that's only 30 years old this summer, and it's still a hot, recurrent country classic.
You have been writing songs since age 5, basically, when you wrote the song B.A.R. Tell us about that song.
That's a complicated song. I wrote that song sitting in a Motown cherry tree. My father was a really good daddy, but he was an alcoholic. And I used to say that when the factories were going 24-7 in Detroit, the bars were going 24-7, too, when people got off shifts. So I'd be moving through the city with my father, and he would pull up and tell me I'll be back in the car when the clock hands get to this point. And he would point to some place on the dial. And he was always there before the clock hand got there. But that day, I looked up at some letters hanging in the sky. As night was falling, I said, "Daddy, don't go in that VAR." I didn't know what it was inside the door because I'd never been inside the door. But I could read those letters, VAR. And he said, "I've been pulled you in front of too many of these if you read those letters to me." So my father didn't not go in the bar. He just took me with him. And so we both went in the bar, and he sat me up on a bar stool, and I got something with a maraschino cherry in it. Fast forward, the house where I was living then with my father and my aunt and my mother had yard on all four sides, and on one of the yards had four or five fruit trees, and one was a cherry tree. And I would sit up in the limbs of that cherry tree, and I would sing to the birds and watch the John C. Lodge freeway and watch the cars rolling like ocean to me, and I'd sing to the birds. And at first it would be songs I had heard on the radio, heard on the record player at my aunt's, heard mainly on the record player or on the radio. And eventually I just started singing, "Daddy, don't go in that VAR. Please don't leave me alone in the car. Something wishing on a star. Daddy, don't go in that VAR." That song, I brought it to Nashville with me. All in the 80s. In 1982, I came down for just a short trip before I moved in 83. And I had a chance to sit with Archie Jordan, who had written "What a Difference You Make in My Life" and some other huge hits. And he looked through all the fragments of songs I had, and he hits B.A.R. He said, "That's the hit." Mm-hmm. I said, "That happened to me." He said, "I know." I said, "How do you can't know that." He said, "No one could have invented that. That's the hit. That happened to you." I connect that to X's and O's. Almost every word in the first verse of "That Happened to Me" and every word in the second verse happened to Matresa Berg, my co-writer. The great songs come when you distill some truth from your life and turn it into some truth that makes sense in a lot of folks' lives. I hear that all in 16 Carriages. But for me, X's and O's is my most autobiographical song, along with B.A.R., "Daddy, go in that B.A.R." And that one never got recorded because I could never share it with anyone else. I could never evolve it past what it was because it was too precious to me. So now it just sits as my very first song, and it's an unrecorded one.
How did you fall in love with country music? Was it white music to you then? Did you understand it that way? Or did you always know it was also black?
I did not understand it as white music because I don't think it's white music.
Right.
You have to remember, I was born in 1959. So modern sounds in country and Western will drop, I think it's in 63. And this is the great Ray Charles. So that is the record. My Aunt Mary Frances played that record over and over and over and over. So that's one influence that you get there. Then a lot of what we hear as black gospel is actually country. And some of what is called blues is actually country. So I was hearing, but the first thing I really heard a lot of was that Ray Charles. So I was hearing black music that was country, modern sounds in country and Western music. But also note that my daddy was pointing out to me that the banjo was a black instrument, an African instrument. I knew that when a lot of folks didn't. And so when we would hear even the Andy Griffith Show, my father would point to that and say, jug band music is something that came from black folks. The banjo came from black folks, that these darlings or whatever might be planted on this show, but that's not the way it really is.
So this listener Lucy writes, can Ms. Randall speak to the third leg of the stool, the fact that U.S. country music evolved not only from the white Celtic tradition and the work of black artists, but also the Latino influence from the South, from border music with its own instrumentation?
Absolutely. One of the things, let's get into the cowboy music parts of that. That I always say that 20-30% of cowboys were black and brown. And when I'm talking about brown cowboys, I'm talking about indigenous and Mexican cowboys that were a very big part of the 19th century and early 20th century cowboy culture. And there were actually cowboy camps with Spanish language songs in them that we know that were found as early as 1907. They predate that. And then if you look at the original families that actually founded the city of Los Angeles, more than half of them were black and brown. So I think there is very much a very extremely important black and brown cowboy culture that is going back to the 18th century. And so that's something that I'm very, I think that we need to even do more research on it. And one of the songs that I love right now is a complicated song, but it is called, it's Shy Carter and Frank Ray, who is a Latino singer. And it's called I Met Jesus at the Taco Truck. And it's a very serious song about the sacredness of this man that is at the taco truck. And it's an immigration rights song. It's a deep song, I Met Jesus at the Taco Truck. And it is a duet between a man who identifies as Latino and a man who identifies as black. And I love that song.
I want to talk about your new album now, My Black Country. Your music has been recorded by white artists like Yearwood for X's and O's. Until now, you have your daughter, Caroline Randall Williams, singing X's and O's on the album. You have Adia Victoria singing Went for a Ride. And I'm wondering what it's like for you to hear your songs re-recorded and sung by black artists. Black artists you envisioned as you wrote the songs.
It is, for me, a Juneteenth moment. It is good news at long last and overdue. Because it's not just the artists, it's the characters. It's the heroes in the songs. That when Adia Victoria sings Girls Ride Horses 2, people imagine one competent black cowboy telling the story of another competent black cowboy. And that's the story that was embedded in the song from the very beginning. I actually was interviewed by someone who admitted in the last 2 weeks that song begins, he was black as the sky on a moonless night. I was interviewed by a music journalist who admitted to me that they had heard the song on the Radney Foster album originally, and it never had occurred to them that that cowboy was black, physically black. And it's just, but, or Alison Russell sings Many Mansions. And that was a song that the kernel of that came to me when I was living in New York. And my daughter was just a weeks old baby. It was 1987. And we're beginning to see one of the first waves of a big homelessness crisis. And I had seen a black woman who I think had come up from the South and was freezing on the streets of New York, seeing life still by winter's bitter chill. But when Mo Bandy sings that, people are imagining a white Southerner who falls apart in the streets of New York, not the black woman I was thinking about. When Alison Russell sings it, and she actually rewrote the line to say, in my mother's house are many mansions, we may realize that all kinds of Southerners, black, brown, and white, have migrated to big cities and got lost, got in the grips of untreated mental illness, end up living on the streets where they can die.
Well, I want to play a little bit from Went for a Ride. This is your song off the album My Black Country, sung by Adia Victoria.
Thank you.
around you. You are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, and we are tapping our feet to tracks from Cowboy Carter and My Black Country with Alice Randall, who's written a new book called My Black Country, A Journey Through Country's Music, Black Past, Present, and Future. And you, our listeners, are weighing in with your thoughts and experiences around country music. Johnny writes, my family immigrated from the Soviet Union when I was 10 in 1977. Everything was strange, including the music. We weren't used to rock. Of course, there was classical music, but for pop music, we wanted a song with a nice melody and not too much heavy backbeat. We discovered country on the radio. Having no idea about what it stood for socially or politically, I listened to country on and off for the next 20 years or so. And another listener writes, Rhiannon Giddens is a folk singer and multi-instrumentalist who also happens to be a classically trained opera singer. Having grown up in North Carolina, she's now on a mission to reframe the history of African Americans and their contributions to the musical landscape. And of course, you talked about her earlier, Alice. Do you want to just say who are today's Black women artists who you think should be household names? Because it is, Beyoncé is shining a spotlight on Black women's role in country music. But there have been many, especially throughout the years, as we know, and we've talked about some already, but more recent, who are currently artists now.
Well, one, Rhiannon Giddens is a great place to begin, and also the entire team that makes up our Native Daughters. Three of them are on this on my album, I'm So Excited, of My Black Country, Layla Michaela, Allison Russell, and Rhiannon Giddens. These are extraordinary performers, and I recommend them. I just adore Rhiannon. I talked to her in Ireland this morning. And I also am extremely interested in One the Duo. They're an act that I find very appealing. They are a mother-daughter act, not completely unlike the Judds. And like the Judds, they are extraordinary, and listening to them will be well rewarded. Another, we already mentioned Yola, but Miko Marks, Sunny War, who's on our album, I adore again her work. She almost has a Nina Simone approach vocally, but she has some of the wildest imagery that is fireflies, but reimagined. It's a punk Black country. That's all I can tell you. Let yourself be surprised on our album. She does a wonderful song about sex workers on the Western frontier called Solitary Hero that I love. Those are some of the acts that I think that really deserve a lot of listening right now. I also think people should look into some of the Black pop acts that have ventured into country in earlier eras. The Supremes, Lionel Richie. If you only listen to one, listen to Aaron Neville, The Grand Tour. He out George Jones. And when you can out George Jones, that is absolutely something. The Pointer Sisters, San Francisco. We cannot ignore them. Their song Fairy Tale was vocal, won the Grammy for a vocal duo of the, or vocal, it wasn't duo, it must have been vocal group of the year in country. And it was a it's a stunning album, a stunning song. And they wrote that song. They performed that song. They should be acknowledged as progenitors. They are, I consider them some kind of cousins of Herb Jeffries and my founding family. They're the hippy dippy country. The Wooten brothers, who a lot of you may know as the Flecktones, who play with Bella Fleck, are geniuses making country. I think, you know, a couple of them have 5 or 6 Grammys, but they've performed together as a Good Time Family Band in an amusement park when they were growing up. And you can look at that on YouTube. And that is the all-time best Black country family band I've ever heard. I love their work.
So I actually want to go out on the song that Rhiannon Giddens sings on My Black Country, The Ballad of Sally Ann. And before we do you want to say anything about it?
Stunningly produced by Ebony Smith, has Rhiannon's extraordinary banjo on it that is also on Beyoncé's record.
Yes.
It's also on Texas Hold'em. Ebony also adds horns to this song. Now, if you listen to all this hour, you know that part of that is a homage to Lil Hardin and the horns on Blue Yodel No. 9. But more significantly in this case, those horns are to remind us that lynching is not an artifact of the 19th century. It happened into the middle of the 20th century. And we have Rhiannon singing this as embodied resistance. She is the black woman whose husband was lynched between his wedding and reception. I love Rhiannon for holding that up.
Well, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you.
It's a pleasure to be here in San Francisco. I can't wait. I want to come to Marcus Bookstore. It's one of my favorite bookstores in the entire country. I went to my first book tour there, Wyndongong, for hours. We went to almost midnight. I hope I get to come back to Marcus literally or virtually.
Alice Randall, thank you. Thanks, Caroline Smith, for producing today's segment. Thank you, listeners. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.